Hey everyone, this is James Mackey and welcome to the Breakthrough Hiring Show. Join us as we cover high-level thought leadership and step-by-step guides on how to make people a competitive advantage for your organization. I'm incredibly proud to be the CEO of Secure Vision, the sponsor of this show and the number one contract recruiting, embedded recruiting, and RPO firm. A thank you to our partners, Greenhouse, the hiring operating system for people-first companies, and GEM, the all-in-one hiring solution recruiters love. Let's go! Hello, welcome to the Breakthrough Hiring Show. I'm your host, James Mackey. Today, we are joined by Gianna Driver. Gianna, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, James. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, we're very excited to host you. And before we jump into it, could you share a little bit about your background with everyone?
Yeah, so I am based in the San Francisco Bay Area, and I've been in the HR tech space for about 20 years, which is kind of crazy to think. And I've worked in organizations that are everything from small startup companies with, you know, 10, 20 people, all the way to many multi-thousands of people, big public companies. My sweet spot and where I get really excited is that 500 to 1,000 person size organization. And at Exabeam, where I am currently, we're a cybersecurity company and roughly 700 global FTEs.
That's really great. And so I love the fact that you have experience at different stages at scale and running different size organizations, and specifically your sweet spot, talking about scale-ups, category-leading companies. When you talk about performance, you really, when you get to that level of success and to sustain that level of success, performance and how we think about critically building teams, everything when it comes to performance, to diversity, and everything else becomes increasingly more important. And some could say even challenging, right? Making sure that the entire organization is on board and aligned and whatnot. So let's start with hiring, right? We're talking about building high-performing teams. It's a big topic. Let's start high-level philosophy approach to when you think about you're joining a new organization, you want to focus on ensuring that you're getting the folks that are going to be the best value add to the organization. What do you focus on? Where do you start?
Mm-hmm, definitely. So I love this question, partly because, you know, I think the philosophy that comes to mind is seek first to understand and then to be understood. So when joining an organization, I think it's important to understand what's our differentiator? What are the key, you know, components and competencies of this job? And then as we go about trying to fill these positions, it's important to think through skills and competencies. Experiences matter because that helps to inform competencies, but I'm of the mind that we shouldn't over-rotate for experience. And I think when we're able to think through competencies and abilities and also potential, we're able to really intentionally craft our organization.
For sure. And so one of the things that we discussed on the prep call was getting into kind of the mindset shift from culture fit to culture ed. Mm-hmm. I've heard of that before. I don't think everybody has. It's something that's coming up more and more, but would you mind explaining to us what that means and how you think about that?
Yeah. So, you know, I think probably 10 or so years ago, the in vogue thing to say was culture fit. It's really important as we build and scale teams that we look for the right culture fit. And I think the more evolved way of looking at growth and scale is around culture add. And what that means is we're not looking to hire people who are exactly as we are today, right? Because then you end up having more of the same. We actually want to focus on intentionally creating environments where we're hiring folks who are different than our existing workforce, because we want people to be innovative and to bring new ideas and different ways of thinking into our product mix, our sales strategy, you know, all of our bottom line processes. So being intentional about hiring people who don't just fit the mold, but who are also not so far afield that they're going to be disruptive, right? So there's that happy medium.
So how do you go about doing that, right? Because you're leading quite a large organization, and you know, how much of it are you working directly with function leaders, VPs of engineering, sales, working with talent acquisition? How do you ensure alignment, and how do you think about like implementation of that? I mean, what does that process look like?
Yeah, great question. I think part of it begins with hiring manager training. So making sure that we're all speaking the same language and that we are grounded in our commitment, that this is something we as an organization value. We are committed to looking at culture add. We're committed to looking at candidates through the lens of potential, not only experience. And then I think having a structured interview process where you've got different interviewers and hiring folks who are asking and screening on different parts of what we've just just discussed. So I think there are probably many people who can relate to interviewing at companies and being asked the same question four different ways from four different people versus an environment where you've got someone who is primarily looking at the cultural attributes of a person. How are they going to impact culture? What is it like to disagree with them? And then you've got someone who is looking at experiences and, you know, key achievements and things like that. And others who might be, if it's an engineering position, as you were mentioning, you know, they might be looking to make sure this person has the skills required to do the job. But I think it starts by, at the onset, being very structured and prepared as we go about growth and scale.
Yeah, I always think that I think one of the biggest missed opportunities is that I feel like actually a lot more time should be spent upfront working with hiring managers and talent acquisition leaders prior to a role being opened.
Yes.
I feel 100%. Like we see so much inefficiency in terms of once a role is open, refining, changing, closing, opening, making the wrong hires, and really just tripping all over ourselves a lot of the time versus being a little bit slower in the planning phase, being intentional about everything from culture and otherwise around what we should be hiring for, because it just saves so much time. I mean, I think one of the analogies, actually, I did a podcast yesterday, but I was like, you know, thinking about it is like when you invest in a person, right? You invest in an employee, you believe that they're going to be a great culture add and value creator, performer for the business. It's a large investment that you're making, not only in their salary and total compensation package, but also in the hiring manager's time, the mm-hmm. leadership's time, the recruiter's time, the candidate's time. I mean,
onboarding, all of that. Yeah.
It's a huge cost, right? And it's significantly larger than I think a lot of folks truly realize. And what's kind of funny about it is like, if someone, let's just say, I'm going to pull out a ballpark number for and hire. Let's just say it's like, you know, when you include onboarding and ramp, everything, your initial investment from hiring to onboarding, let's just say costs $100,000, right? Something like that, right? You wouldn't like, none of us would take $100,000 and invest it into a business with no business plan.
Right.
Like, we'd never take like, hey, here's $100,000. Like, let's just hope it's going to work out.
Right.
And yet, like, I feel like we aren't always consciously doing that. But sometimes I feel like in some organizations, like that's kind of the mindset. Like, we're going to hire the person and the rest can kind of take care of itself. But there isn't enough clarity into, are we making the right investment? Do we really know what we need to be investing in? And how do we have a plan to ensure that investment has the right ROI that we're looking for, whether it be culture, performance, whatever else? Mm-hmm. I think that there also needs to be a mindset shift, not only from culture fit to culture ads, but also when we're thinking about investing in folks, like, are we really being as intentional as we should be?
Mm-hmm. I agree 100%. And I think once we've got that clarity as a hiring manager, HR team, talent team, whatnot, then I think it's also important to make sure others in the interview process are clear about that. I don't know how many times I've been in interview processes where there's not that alignment throughout all of the folks who are on the interview panel. And what ends up happening is we have a very protracted interview cycle. And, you know, one person's looking for this and someone who can, you know, do X, Y, Z. Someone else is looking for someone who is an absolutely different profile. And we end up wasting a lot of time, right? So it ends up becoming very inefficient. The quote that comes to mind is, you've probably heard this, measure twice, cut once. And so, you know, spending some time measuring and being really intentional and thoughtful about, okay, here is the who, right? So kind of that profile of skills and competency. And here's what they're going to be doing at our organization. And here's how we want them to be doing it. I think that alignment up front saves a lot of inefficiency down the road.
Oh, it does. It 100% does. I would say just so folks don't understand my perspective, I run a company called Secure Vision. And we do contract recruiting, embedded recruiting, and RPO. For the past decade, we've done it for over 200 companies, primarily startup growth stage, a handful of enterprise publicly traded firms, primarily in the tech space. And this is consistently, like, it's an issue more times than not when it comes mm-hmm. to not slowing down enough and really defining everything from a culture to a performance to an onboarding. There just usually hasn't been enough prep time and strategy and process put in place before, hey, we got to go out and hire, you know, 300 engineers or whatever it might be to over the next year, right?
Well, sometimes you have to slow down in order to really speed up, right?
Yeah.
So kind of being really methodical and saying, okay, here's where we are and here's where we want to go. And let's really kind of, you know, craft that journey, I think saves time down the road.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's just too, it's, you know, particularly in 2021, it's like, you know, what I, one of the conversations that's been happening a little bit more recently, and specifically really led by Sam Jacobs. He's the CEO of a company called Pavilion, which is a community base for executives, a lot of revenue leaders, and they also have like a CEO group. But one of the thing that, you know, things that, that Sam talks about is that in 2021 specifically, a lot of people really didn't understand what scale meant. You know, scale is building repeatable profitability, maintaining somewhat similar unit economics, right? Similar margin as we scale and building a sustainable business. But it's like in 2021, it's almost like people saw scale as hire as many people as fast as possible. And it's, you know, if you don't have the right plan in place, it's like, you're really just adding a ton of overhead, right? I mean, you're not necessarily scaling the organization and you're not doing any favors to anybody. And it's not like, hey, if we just add 20 people, it's going to solve our problems.
And thus we find ourselves in the right sizing exercise that's been painful for many of us in the tech space in 2023.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's been a brutal year in tech when it comes to that, for sure. So
yeah,
hopefully we're coming out the other end of that soon. We'll see.
Yes. Smarter.
Yeah. We would, I'd like to think so, right? It's like, how many times do we have to have our hand burn on the stovetop, right? So we'll see. But anyway, so I think just getting back to thinking about culture, a big part of that is diversity. Mm-hmm. You know, it's, we've seen a lot of companies make a big push over the past few years to improve diversity practices, inclusion, really thinking about how to measure this properly and actually have it more, have it be more than, okay, you know, values we put on our careers page. How are we actually tracking toward these goals and everything that comes alongside that? I would love to get your thoughts when you're thinking about building diversity programs in a diverse workforce. How do you build a program that is actually tracking and making progress? And what are the different things that you take into consideration as you're building out your diversity strategy?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Great question. You know, I think a lot of organizations are in a place where they say that commitment to diversity, equity, inclusion, belonging is something paramount, and they want to make sure that they're building diverse teams. But what ends up happening is without a holistic strategy and approach, we end up having these random acts of diversity. And when you have random acts of diversity, that typically leads to a pretty disorganized and fraught employee experience because we're not streamlined and consistent in our approach to diversity and inclusion and belonging. Examples of that might mean organizations are so focused and committed to hiring underrepresented talent, and then they, you know, focus on other things. That's only one step in a many-step journey to building a diverse and inclusive workplace. So yes, having underrepresented minorities, you know, join an organization, yes, it starts there with that, like, representation matters. And if you don't have the folks there, then, you know, yes, that's part of it. But then also ensuring that we have workplaces where people are able to, and psychologically safe environments, express their thoughts, that people are able to disagree in kind and respectful ways, that people are able to listen, and that we're also clear about who has decision-making authority. Now, what I think about is diverse workplaces come with built-in disagreement. Inherent in diversity is that you're going to have people who are likely very impassioned, and they've got different perspectives coming at trying to solve problems. That's wonderful. That's what we want. But we need to be really intentional about creating structures so that we don't just have a bunch of chaotic folks disagreeing with one another, but we actually are able to harness and leverage the diversity of thought and experience to have really great solutions.
So I think one of the things you said on your prep call specifically, it's like, you know, a lot of companies are looking at diversity through the lens of from just hiring, right? Like, their entire strategy or metrics or everything that they're tracking is specifically related to the hiring process and percentages and improving percentages and whatnot, like these types of things. But one of the things you said in the prep call is like, really, the real work starts once you have built a diverse team. And I think it's like doing those two things in parallel while you're thinking about it, you know, hiring more of a diverse team. Also, what are you doing to produce an environment that is going to be inclusive and where folks are going to be able to communicate effectively? And I think that's probably, again, something that should be done in parallel, where I think a lot of times it's not. It's like, we're focused on hiring, and then they haven't focused on the other part of it, and they've essentially already started off like falling behind and unsure about the right steps to take, right?
Absolutely, because these things, to your point, can't be done in a linear fashion where, okay, we're going to focus on hiring. Okay, once we feel like we're doing a good job there and we're bringing diverse folks here, now we're going to focus on, you know, the belonging piece. No, to your point, like all of this has to be done in a structured approach concurrently, right? And I think you had mentioned this earlier, looking at metrics and data helps us understand a baseline, but B, how are we doing? So, and I don't mean just the metrics of having diverse folks in the organization. I also mean in our engagement surveys, let's do data cuts where we're looking at this through the lens of underrepresented minorities. What is their engagement score? How are they feeling about things? You know, let's start to, in our merit processes, our promotion processes, look through the lens of gender and ethnicity and veteran status and, you know, all of these other types of ways that we organize and classify ourselves. Right? Because I think then we start to see trend lines and we can correct and address. And I think it's important to note perfection is likely never going to be achieved. And I think that's okay. But it allows us, if we've got the North Star there, we can constantly pivot and shift because our workplace is constantly in a state of change, right? Like workplaces are dynamic. We have people entering and leaving all the time. So constantly evaluating and then correcting and addressing is going to be critical to getting it right.
For sure. I think also one of the other aspects to creating a healthy culture is we talked a little bit about, we wanted to discuss performance alongside culture, right? And in some cases, we may have situations even where somebody may be able to perform the tasks or responsibilities or produce the outcomes that are needed from the perspective of a job description, right? But maybe aren't necessarily the best folks to work with from the perspective of being toxic or something like that. So that's mm-hmm. another really important part of culture, which can be really difficult to manage to, particularly from an executive level, mm-hmm. but it's also incredibly important. So when you think about performance and when you think about maybe some of the, in this case, like challenges that you may have with somebody who might be toxic, for instance, how do you reconcile that? And what do you do? It's a tough one.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I've thought about this a fair bit, and I'll give you some specific anecdotes and examples. I've been in situations where we've got someone who is performing from a metrics and numbers standpoint, meaning they're crushing their quota, or in non-sales environments, they're meeting the KPIs and the release dates or whatever it is. So functionally speaking, they are doing a stellar job. However, culturally speaking, they're toxic. And so I think the question is around, how do we handle these types of situations where someone is crushing it from a goals perspective, but they're just not doing it in a nice way? This is where I think we as leaders are really tested and challenged. My personal opinion, and I believe very strongly about this, is the no jerks policy is super critical. And by the way, those out there in some organizations have more strong language around this, but for our conversation today, we'll say the no jerks policy. I think it is critical that we walk the walk and don't just do lip service to this. So the how someone does something, in my opinion, is equally important to the what. So if someone is achieving and the what part is being solved, but they are culturally cancerous to the organization, that, in my opinion, is unacceptable. And we need to have really hard and honest conversations with them, give them every chance to succeed. And if they are still not to a place where the how part is kind and respectful and inclusive, then I think we need to help them find their next opportunity.
Sure. And so that makes a lot of sense to me. I think it's when we're thinking about implementing that, right, or really delivering on that, particularly from your role, right, which you have a rather large organization, you have a lot of different leaders that you're working with to ensure that they're aligned and on the same page. First off, how do you really uncover if there's an issue? And then how do you do so in a way that's consistent and not biased? I mean, how do you structure that?
Mm-hmm. Yep. So there's not a silver bullet panacea that's going to solve this. I can't say, James, oh, you just do this one thing. And if you look at that, then you know what? You got all your answers there. But typically, it is a multitude of data points that we look at in aggregate, right? And so it could be, let's look at attrition. Often, poor managers end up having pretty high attrition rates relative to the trend lines in the overall organization. So that could be an indication of a problem. We could look at engagement rates across different, leaders and managers in an organization. But then also, aside from all of these types of things, have conversations, have an environment where people are okay giving feedback to one another, have an environment where HR business partners or people partners are front and center in a lot of these conversations. And if you listen, your employees know who's toxic and who's not. And so then it's incumbent upon us to act accordingly. Once we have this information to help someone get better and work with more respect or right. let them know that's not acceptable.
Yeah. And I think you made a really good point when you're honing in on leaders, specifically hiring managers, because the leverage and impact is so much greater, right? Like, but he's leading an organization of anywhere from, even if it's a small team of five people, to an organization of 20, 30 people plus, that's going to impact everybody that funnels up through them on the org chart. So mm-hmm. I think starting there and having a really firm grasp on that is probably the most important, I would say.
Yeah. An accountability culture, right? Where to your point, it's the work metrics, but also that, you know, these leaders are holding their folks accountable and they're holding themselves accountable.
And I think another interesting point you made was thinking about attrition rates on a per department level, on a per team basis, and mm-hmm. benchmarking based on that to identify, okay, you heard something anecdotally about, you know, maybe something's going on here or we need to look into this. But then from a metric perspective, what can you actually look at to, as a potential indicator, not a standalone metric, but what are different things you can look at? And I think attrition is a really interesting one. And I've actually heard it brought up a couple of times recently when we were thinking about attrition on a per team or per department basis for a lot of reasons, not only in this use case, but there's a fair amount of use cases actually when it comes down to running an effective organization, understanding attrition on a per department basis, and everything from how we think about recruiting to how we think about career progression and employee lifetime value and engagement. And there's just a lot to be considered. And it's cool to see. I think the attrition on a per team basis is really important. I think a lot of organizations, maybe ones that are a little bit younger, but a lot of them are looking at attrition basically at a company-wide level.
Right.
They're not dialing in on a per team basis, which is, of course, I think a lot more useful.
And I think equally important to attrition is also employee sentiment. Because remember, mm-hmm. attrition is a lagging indicator, right? So attrition means someone's already left, they've departed already. And that's useful information. So I agree 100%. Let's dive into, you know, a team and or manager level if needed. Equally important, though, is also employee sentiment. So this is how people feel today, because that is something we can do something about, right? If someone has already exited the organization, then, you know, that's that they're gone. As opposed to employee sentiment or employee engagement, here at Exabeam, we call this ENPS, so the employee net promoter score, so that we're able to get a gauge and sense for, okay, across the organization and by function, here's how people are currently feeling. There are also some really interesting tools and like analytics types of things that will do language processing on an aggregate sort of basis and essentially let you know, okay, here are pockets of potential concern, right? And then that becomes actionable for us because, again, attrition is something that you can't necessarily do anything about because it's happened already versus sentiment information is actionable.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. And it's one of the many areas where you can have a revenue organization parallel to people organizations, in a sense, running net promoter scores and whatnot. When you're doing net promoter scores, assuming it's anonymous to an extent, but then also it's on a per department basis. So how do you do it in such a way that's anonymous, but also specific?
Yep. So there are lots of amazing tools out there that help with this. Usually the N has to be 5 or greater for it to be reported, right? Because if the number of reporting individuals is less than 5, then often it's identifying information, which frankly just defeats the purpose, right? Like, I think as leaders in organizations, it's less useful to think about who is saying which things, but let's kind of rise above the, you know, that level of detail and kind of think about, okay, what is the overall messaging that my employees and teams are telling me? So usually, whether it's, you know, Lattice is the tool that we use here at Exabeam, which is fantastic at this, you have to have an N greater than 5 in order for it to give you, you know, information.
Okay. Yeah. That sounds like a good policy to have. Yeah, because I would think like folks, if they're on a smaller team, would feel a little bit awkward about giving feedback.
Right. No, you're exactly right. And I think that it's important that we respect and adhere to the anonymity threshold, right? Like, if we tell our employees that it truly is anonymous, then we need to do right by that and ensure that it actually is. And many of the tools out there force organizations to stick to that. So we use an N of 5.
And how often do you send these out?
So we do an annual engagement survey, but then we do more frequent pulse surveys. So our thesis is that on an annual level, it's good to, in a like many question format, kind of get a sense for how we're doing, what's working, what are areas of improvement. And then based off of that, we'll do more curated and targeted pulse surveys that are more frequent. And so that could be anywhere from 1 to 4 or 5 questions.
Okay, cool. So it sounds like it's a very regular, proactive, consistent feedback loop.
Yeah. And it's funny, depending on who you ask, I'm like, oh, it's too regular or it's not regular enough, right? So
this is actually something that I'm seeing a trend with as well at a lot of the top performing organizations, executives that I've been speaking with on the show, really dialing into communication and feedback between executives and employees. And it's interesting. It's happening a lot. Like a lot of executives are very adamant about it being on a monthly basis, in some ways communicating on a weekly basis. You know, we had Debbie Shotwell, she's the chief people officer over at Stack Overflow. And she was talking about how their CEO writes a letter to the company every Friday. It's not exactly what we're talking about, but the idea of communicating and feedback loops. And, you know, it seems that a lot of the top organizations are
taking that really, very seriously. Yeah.
Very seriously. And it's when you get to a point where you start to hear this from a lot of the top chief HR officers, such as yourself and everybody else have been speaking to, the folks that have been doing this a while are going to tell you that this is one of the most important things that they do in order to increase employee engagement and hire and retain top talent.
Absolutely. I tell my like fellow leaders as well as my teams, when you feel like you're over communicating, you're probably communicating just enough.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, nobody's going to come back to you like you're being too transparent. Like,
giving me so much information and context. Yeah.
People want it. People definitely want it and they appreciate it. It goes a long way.
Especially in a hybrid environment, which is the world in which many of us live and operate. I think for that to be successful, feedback rich environments where communication is a norm is essential to success.
I definitely agree. So Gianna, we're coming up on time here. I wanted to say thank you so much for joining me today. This was a lot of fun. Thanks for being here.
This is great, James. Thanks so much.
Of course. And for everybody tuning in, thank you so much. We'll see you next time. Take care.
Thank you for tuning in to the Breakthrough Hiring Show. We hope you've enjoyed today's episode and gained a lot of valuable insights to help guide your talent strategy. I also want to say thank you to my team at Secure Vision for making the show possible. Secure Vision is the number one embedded recruitment provider, and we are a 3-time category leader on G2. Secure Vision partners with over 150 companies to provide on-demand recruiters who specialize in either tech, revenue, or G&A. For more information, you can visit securevision.io. For more content, you can follow me on LinkedIn at James Mackey or on Twitter at James Mackey DMV. We've dropped links in the description. If you want to be on our show or have any topics you'd like for us to cover, reach out at breakthroughhiring.io. We really appreciate your support with reviews on Apple Podcasts. And lastly, make sure to tune in every Tuesday and Thursday for a new episode. See you next time.